Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. With roughly 12,000 Amish residents, Wisconsin now has the fourth largest Amish population in the United States. Rural corners of central and western Wisconsin are popular destinations for Amish fleeing creeping congestion and secular prosperity in other states, drawn in by low farm prices, fertile land, and longtime dairy industries. But with their secluded lifestyle, their children, beliefs, and traditions can be often misunderstood. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Siewert, and we welcome listeners to the West Side. The Amish follow the teachings of Jacob Ammann, a 17th century citizen of Switzerland, and they trace their roots to the Anabaptist movement. Closely related to, but different from, the Mennonites, the Amish people follow simple customs and traditions, rejecting many forms of modern technology and conveniences. Though most Amish groups share certain practices, including the use of horse and buggy for local transportation, rejection of electricity, and a distinctive style of dress, there are many different affiliations, each of which has its own traditions. And a recent Ohio State University study found that the Amish are growing faster than any faith-based group in the U.S., with 60% of all Amish settlements founded since 1990. Dozens are in central and western Wisconsin. Joining us today is University of Wisconsin Professor Mark Loudon, an expert on Amish communities, to help us better understand our Amish neighbors. He is a professor of German linguistics who serves as an interpreter and cultural mediator for Amish and Old Order Mennonite groups in the legal and healthcare systems. Mark, welcome to Route 51.
Thank you very much, Shereen. It's nice to be here this morning.
Listeners with questions for our guests can join the conversation by calling us at 800-780-9742 or emailing us at ideas@wpr.org. So, Mark, let's start with some history. The Amish were early adopters of a new belief system centuries ago. When did that all begin?
So, yes, the Amish are part of what's known as the Anabaptist family of churches, which includes today the Mennonites, as you referred to, also a communal Anabaptist group known as the Hutterites, who are not represented in Wisconsin, but are heavily concentrated in the prairie provinces of Canada and also the Dakotas and western Minnesota, and a little bit farther west as well. And then Churches of the Brethren. So those are the four major branches of the Anabaptist movement: Mennonites, Amish, Hutterites, and Brethren. And the Anabaptist movement began as an outgrowth of the Reformation that was going on in Central Europe, associated with very prominent leaders like, for example, Martin Luther and John Calvin, and in Switzerland, an early reformer named Ulrich Zwingli. And this was all beginning really in the early decades of the 16th century, so the early 1500s. And the Anabaptists shared a lot in common with other, quote-unquote, more mainstream reformers who would be known as Protestants today, including, you know, rejection of a lot of sort of higher church practices and certain doctrines that were common in the Western Christian church for centuries before that. But the Anabaptists had a few distinctives that set them apart from other more mainstream reformers, and probably the most distinctive practice was their belief that baptism, which is sort of a requirement for the process toward eventual hoped-for salvation, that baptism is a step that should be taken with one's eyes wide open, that it should be a conscious decision that one makes as a rational person. So it's something that should not happen to you as, for example, a baby, an infant, but it should be a step that you take as an adult or a young adult. And so this is known as the practice of believer's baptism. And the term Anabaptist itself is a translation of a German term that was actually used at the time by the critics of the Anabaptists, which included not only members of the Roman Catholic Church, but especially their Protestant neighbors in places like Switzerland and Germany. And that term is a translation of the German word Wiedertäufer, which means literally rebaptizer. And the reason for that was that the Anabaptists, who themselves practiced adult baptism, the earliest members of the group in the early 1500s, had all been baptized themselves as infants, right? They had all been members of, at that time, state churches. And for the most part, they were members of the Swiss Reformed Church. And rebaptizing is a major no-no, right, in really all Christian churches. So that the idea that somehow, you know, it's a do-over, we're going to do it a second time, that was considered basically heretical and by the state seditious. But the Anabaptists argue and say, well, we didn't know what we were doing. It was not a conscious choice. And therefore, it's not a rebaptism. It's actually a proper baptism. So that was probably the first major distinctive step away from the other more mainstream reformers. And that the Anabaptist movement then became known as part of what was called the Radical Reformation.
So when did the Amish come to the U.S.? What brought them here?
So the Amish... So the earliest Anabaptist group eventually became known as Mennonites, and we'll be talking about sort of like the difference between Amish and Mennonites, but Mennonites numerically still are the largest Anabaptist group. And that really goes back, even though the name isn't as old as this, but goes back to 1525 in Zurich, Switzerland. That's really the beginning of the Anabaptist movement. The Amish were a conservative branch off of the group that was known as the Swiss Brethren, or later as the Swiss Mennonites, who emerged around in the 1690s, so roughly 170 years after the Anabaptist movement began. And they were living in Switzerland at that time. 1693 is kind of a key year, but many of them had already been driven out of Switzerland into what is today southwestern Germany and eastern France, the German-speaking part of eastern France, driven out because of religious persecution for the most part. And so the Amish were really kind of clustered actually mainly in the Rhineland area in eastern France. And that's actually where Jacob Amman, the man that you referred to before, the namesake, the Amish, lived. And so it was 1690s that the Amish became known as a distinctive group among Anabaptists in Central Europe. And it was already by the 17-teens that they started migrating to colonial America. And specifically where they came was colonial Pennsylvania, at the invitation essentially of following in a tradition of other religious groups who had experienced persecution in Europe from Great Britain and Central Europe. William Penn, the namesake of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania means Penn's woods. William Penn was a Quaker, and the Quakers had experienced, there are a lot of external parallels, although no direct connections really until they came to America, but there were a lot of external parallels between religious dissenters in Britain, including the Quakers, and religious dissenters in Central Europe, which included the Amish and Mennonites. And so Mennonites had already come to North America in the 1680s, also to colonial Pennsylvania, and the Amish followed not within a generation after they really kind of came into existence in the 1710s.
What brought them to Wisconsin?
Well, the same reasons that they came to North America, basically looking for economic opportunity. One can say that religious persecution was kind of a push factor to get them and members of other Anabaptist groups and related groups to come to colonial Pennsylvania, but really, the spread into Wisconsin came in the early 20th century, along with the general sort of expansion of population from sort of originally colonial America and the mid-Atlantic states. Already at the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, we see sort of large population shifts from as you know, the frontier of America is moving gradually west. And although the Amish were not the first Euro-Americans in Wisconsin by any stretch of the imagination, and certainly not the first ethnic Germans or German-Americans to come in to the state. They did sort of follow in that tradition of basically kind of from the east to westward movement in search of economic opportunities. And the first Amish community settlement was started in the early 20th century in northwestern Wisconsin. And things really picked up. It was fairly small in terms of growth until like the 1950s, 1960s. That's when the Amish population expanded. And as you indicated, the Amish population in terms of adult members is about 12,000 today, but the actual population, if you figure in children, is closer to 24,000.
Wow.
So the important fact is that if you're born to Amish parents, you are not technically Amish because you have not been baptized, right? You make the formal decision to join the church as a young adult, which among Amish people is somewhere between the ages of 18 and 22. And Amish families have on average between triple and quadruple the number of kids versus the general North American average. So they're having on the average somewhere around 7 kids per family. And that coupled with their high retention rate between 85 and 90% of young people who are born to Amish parents make the choice to formally join the church as young adults. that accounts for the growth that you referred to before. It's exponential. Their populations are doubling every 20 years, which is not only the highest rate for any religious group in North America, it's the top rate for any human population on the entire planet. Anyway.
That's interesting. Let's talk a little bit about some of the principles that guide the Amish people and their belief system. I know one is shunning of members who sin. What is that about, and how is that dealt with in Amish communities?
So shunning is not sort of front and center in terms of Amish faith and practice. It's actually, it's one of those aspects of Amish life that gets a lot of popular attention because it's sort of exotic. It kind of sounds like a scarlet letter and negative things that people associate with traditional or conservative religious communities. I wouldn't consider that a sort of main religious doctrine, but it's a form of church discipline. And it's a very rare form of church discipline, actually. So basically, the idea is that there are certain scriptural principles, as laid out especially in the four Gospels, that all Christians are expected to live by, including the Amish. And each individual congregation kind of sets its own sort of rules of kind of setting limits on their interactions with the larger society, and especially in the area of technology. But if there's a person that does, a member of the church, who does something repeatedly that's considered profoundly sinful, and doesn't show any inclination toward repentance, and all other sort of means have failed, then shunning or excommunication and shunning takes place. And basically what that involves is that the member literally excommunicated, meaning they're not permitted to take communion with the larger body. And the shunning does not mean that they're excluded from the community at all. In fact, if they choose to, they continue to live in the community. But it's the way that one Amish person described it was that we're closing the door, but we're leaving it open a crack, right? So the idea is that the person who has done something very, very serious that's hurtful to themselves and the larger community, and this could be, you know, like committing a very grievous sin, right? And especially doing it kind of in a patterned way, that person stop that behavior and there'd be sort of a testing time to make sure that they're living up to that. And then the shunning would be lifted.
Okay. What about the clothing? We've all seen the Amish in our communities, and they wear very distinct outfits. So what is the purpose behind the clothing that they wear?
So that's a good question. So the way that they dress and also groom themselves, so like cutting their hair, beards or not, and hairstyles for men, that sort of thing, dress is part of that. So distinctive dress and grooming is an outward expression, mostly symbolic expression, of a larger principle that stems from their faith, which is the principle of nonconformity. The idea that Christians who are striving to live out their faith in everyday life, so not just on Sundays, but sort of, you know, 24/7, that they're going to need to maintain a certain amount of distance between themselves and the larger society. So be not conformed to worldliness and things like materialism and individualism and greed and these kinds of things that are at odds with the Christian faith. And so one important way of kind of marking that distinctive identity is to dress distinctively. So basically to sort of say, we have made a choice to kind of take a step back from the social mainstream. The actual details of their dress, to a certain extent, go back to the way that they dressed in Switzerland and Central Europe. But some aspects were actually picked up by their Quaker neighbors during the 18th century in colonial America. The way I like to compare it to is like we all identify ourselves through our dress. So, for example, when I go to the grocery store on certain Saturdays or Sundays, I often see a lot of green and gold or a lot of red and white, depending on who's playing those days. And these are the ways that we mark our identity. So we either, you know, we want to say with our clothing, go Pack, right?
Sure.
Or go Badgers, right?
Sure.
And basically the Amish, by wearing things like, you know, black hats and prayer coverings, are essentially saying, I'm on the Amish team. These are my people.
Very interesting. University of Wisconsin professor Mark Loudon is our guest today on Route 51 as we continue our conversation about the Amish people and communities of Wisconsin. When we return, we'll talk about lifestyle and culture and some differences between distinct Amish communities. Your questions and comments are welcome. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Once again, extending a warm welcome to listeners from the West Side, I'm Shireen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shireen Seward, welcoming listeners from the West Side. University of Wisconsin professor Mark Loudon is our guest today for a look at the Amish in central and western Wisconsin. What questions do you have for our guest? You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or join us by phone. The number to call is 800-780-9742. We touched on this a little bit earlier, Mark, but many people confuse the Amish with Mennonites. What is the difference between those two groups?
So historically, the Mennonites are older. Their roots go back to the beginning of what we call the Anabaptist movement in the basically the 1520s. The name Mennonite comes from an early Anabaptist leader who was a contemporary of Martin Luther. His name was Menno Simons, who was actually from what is today the Netherlands, the Frisian region of the Netherlands. And the Mennonites were kind of a loose configuration of Anabaptists living in from basically as far south as Switzerland and as far north as the Netherlands throughout the 16th century and into the 17th century. The Amish were a conservative splinter group off of the Mennonites, and Mennonites are represented worldwide today. So there are actually large populations of Mennonites who are not of ethnic Germanic background living in the Southern Hemisphere. So places like Central and South America, Africa, Asia. The Mennonite movement has been more associated with a kind of mission movement than say, the Amish are, who don't proselytize. In North America, so the United States and Canada, Mennonites are in general, there's a spectrum in terms of there are some so-called old order Mennonites, including in our listening area. Clark County, for example, has a fairly large old order Mennonite population. And these are horse and buggy operating Mennonites who are outwardly somewhat similar to their Amish neighbors, but they have electricity and so there are more differences. But there's a real spectrum in terms of technology. And in general, people who identify as Amish are more traditional or more conservative, especially as regards technology.
Okay. And not all Amish communities are the same either. I know that there are different distinct groups of Amish that are here in Wisconsin. Can you talk a little bit about those subgroups, please?
Sure. Basically, in North America, scholars have identified about at least 40 different Amish subgroups. A consequence of the fact that the Anabaptist movement has never been strongly centralized, that leads to a lot of congregational autonomy. And so over the years, and especially over the 20th century, there have been a lot of, we could say, divisions or sort of distinctive subgroups of Amish emerging. The most, and Wisconsin is kind of a microcosm of that intra-Amish diversity. We have groups, for example, living in the Augusta-Eau Claire area and other parts of the state too, who are referred to as Schwarzentruber Amish, Schwarzentruber being the name of an early Amish bishop, who have very little in the way of technology. The one thing that basically all Amish groups have would be motorized washing machines. They're not fancy front loaders, but they're things like, you know, wringer washers that would be powered by, say, a Honda motor. But then they would have, like, say, no mechanical milkers in their dairies. They would do it by hand. They would not have bulk milk tanks. They would not use power mowers. They wouldn't use Bobcat skid steer loaders. Would not use tractors at all for field work, which is common among most Amish. But some Amish use tractors for belt power at the PTO, the power takeoff shaft at the end. So is a real spectrum from the most traditional to the most progressive, and the differences are not theological. They're really just in terms of adoption of technology.
I thought it was interesting that NPR in a story about the Amish described the use of technology among the Amish as thoughtful rather than frivolous. And I thought that was a really interesting way to describe that. So how a horse and buggy isn't always practical, right? So how else do they travel? I mean, what kinds of exceptions do they make when things like that happen?
So it's not so much about exceptions. It's about the, and it's not their, that they reject technology. That's a very common view, that they somehow are anti-technology or that they're Luddites, that they're selective users of technology. And the choices that they make, which are different across various groups, that's why we have 40 different affiliations. The different choices they make are based on what is going to promote healthy community life. And so it's not an outright rejection of, I mean, they'll say, like, for example, you know, TV and internet access, that's not going to bring any positive things into our community. So we'll reject that outright. But transportation is sort of a good area. So it's every Amish community identifies with using horse and buggy. They still use horse and buggy for local transportation. But they also realize, just as you pointed out, that it's logistically a little bit unhandy if you're talking about visiting relatives and traveling and moving to different places or seeking medical care, these kinds of things. You can't go with horse and buggy. You can't say, go to the Marshfield Clinic or Madison for a checkup, these kinds of things. So then they say, well, then it's perfectly okay to hire a van, right? To hire a so-called Amish taxi driver or to ride public transportation. Anytime you're riding on Amtrak and you're going through Union Station in Chicago, pretty much any time of the year, you're going to see some Amish people there, right? Greyhound bus and other interstate bus transportation, still very, very popular among a lot of Amish. So the difference is, they say, you know, it's what we do for ourselves in terms of what we own and operate ourselves, we prefer horse and buggy, because that keeps communities interacting in a day-to-day level locally. So you can't really just like hop in your vehicle and drive 50 miles away and then just come back. It basically kind of keeps people in close proximity to one another. And if you need to go farther distances, then it's just a little bit unhandy, right? It'll cost something, you have to pay for it, but they see that as sort of a good compromise, right? So kind of promoting local face-to-face community life, face-to-face interactions, and kind of collectively setting the limits on mobility over longer distances. And these are decisions, having to do with, say, transportation, the use of the telephone, these kinds of things. These are all made democratically, right? These are not coming from top to bottom by elders or a bishop or something like that. This is all coming from the baptized members of each congregation itself. And it's they negotiate, you know, among themselves, but by and large, they make decisions which they deem to be in the best interests of their immediate communities.
One of the facets that contribute to confusion about the Amish culture is perhaps their separation from the rest of us. The Amish people refer to people in the non-Amish world as English, and there seems to be a sense that they don't really trust the English. Why is that?
I wouldn't say that they don't trust the English. It's fair to say that pretty much every single Amish family has at least a handful of close relatives who are no longer Amish, right? So they have, you know, cousins who are members of Mennonite churches, other churches, and you really, in many cases, blood is thicker than water. So if you go to, like, say, an Amish family reunion in the summer, it's not going to be exclusively Amish people there. They're going to be there, Mennonite and other, you know, cousins from other groups, people that don't identify with a particular church. They don't live, they live according to a principle of mutual aid and communally in a kind of general sense, but they don't live in communes, right? They don't live in distinct colonies. And they also recognize that they are, you know, connected to the outside world in ways that, you know, are really unavoidable. So even though they don't, say, for example, take electricity from municipal sources, they need to power motors, right? So like the gasoline engines that power the wringer washers. And so they actually have to purchase fuel. An Amish man once said, he said, you know, if we disappeared from the face of the earth tomorrow, no one would miss us. I disagree with that. I would. but on the other hand, if the rest of the world were to disappear, we would disappear along with them, right? So it's not that they feel that they're better or superior. In fact, they would argue just the opposite, right? They say we are absolutely not better or superior to our neighbors. Again, it goes back to that principle of nonconformity. It's like we are part of a larger society, but we want to remain a little bit out of step, out of sync with that society, a little bit nonconformist, right? And this is a choice that they've made collectively, but it's not unusual among the individual choices that a lot of North Americans make. There are some of the, think about Christmas and materialism. There are some of us that feel uncomfortable with beating down the doors of Best Buy or a large, big box store on, Thanksgiving evening to buy a flat screen television and say, this is Christmas, right? Some of us, prefer to take a step back from that kind of expression of materialism. And the Amish would say that and more.
Sure. What about the educational system? Where do the Amish youth go to school and how does that work?
For most of their time in North America, going back almost 300 years now, they attended the same schools as their non-Amish neighbors. So originally, they were sort of community, often church-run schools that were in Pennsylvania interdenominational. So they weren't exclusively for Amish kids or Mennonite kids or Lutheran or Catholic or whatever. Then when public schools emerged in places like Pennsylvania already in the 1830s and moving forward, the kind of classic one-room schoolhouse, Little Red Schoolhouse model of American local education emerged, and the Amish were very much a part of that. Into the 20th century, that was really the model, the kind of Little Red Schoolhouse attending local community-funded public schools. As those schools were closed in rural America, starting in the first half of the 20th century and really accelerating in the 1950s and beyond, and we see the fossils of that driving out in rural Wisconsin and other places, seeing the old one-room schoolhouses, the Amish said, that wasn't broke, let's not fix it. And so basically, they preserved or maintained, they in some cases actually physically bought the old public schoolhouses, one-room schoolhouses, or one- or two-room schoolhouses, and basically have preserved that model of early American public education, but given it a sort of community-wide twist. So the vast majority of Amish kids, some do attend mainstream public schools, but most attend these community-funded parochial schools. The curriculum has definitely been updated, continues to get updated since the mid-20th century, but they are owned and operated by and overseen by Amish school boards.
And how long do children go to school? Do they go through high school? Beyond that, how long are they educated?
Formal education typically stops with eighth grade, so that's the time that when most stop. It's not forbidden to pursue a high school degree, diploma, or even higher education. In places, it's very extremely uncommon in Wisconsin, but in places like northern Indiana, where a large number of Amish males and some females work in factories owned by non-Amish people, in some cases is their main source of income, some of these factories require a GED. And so they will pursue getting a high school equivalency diploma. In other states, especially Pennsylvania, there's a small number of typically women who are interested in careers in healthcare. And so they pursue things like community college degrees and actually have become nurses.
Okay. Can you explain what Rumspringa is? We probably all heard about it. And I know there was a TV show out recently, this Breaking Amish, that kind of gave this idea of what this was like. What is really Rumspringa about? And I mean, is it really like what we saw on TV?
No, that's the short answer. So basically, this is the most misunderstood aspect of Amish life, bar none, in the public eye. So Rumspringa goes back to, is a Pennsylvania Dutch word, which literally means to run around. And you think about it, it's like, okay, well, this is partly where this stereotype comes from. And even Wikipedia gets it wrong. So basically, the popular stereotype is that this is a time when young people are in some cases supported or encouraged by their parents to leave the community, explore the outside world, sow their wild oats, and discern whether they want to come back to the community, settle down, and make a life for themselves as Amish people. So it's kind of like synonymous with sowing one's wild oats. That's not correct. Basically, what Rumspringa is objectively is that when an Amish young person turns 16 years of age, they are given permission to socialize with other young people without adult supervision.
So, really?
Yeah.
All right.
And the vast majority are, doing things like getting together for Sunday evening singings, not drinking alcohol, maybe drinking lemonade, having small get-togethers, dating, playing volleyball, other kind of community games. There is a small subgroup among youth, so between the age of 16 and marriage, who do go wild. These are the stories that make it into the popular media. So like, you know, a kid that gets a six pack of beer and drinks it with his buddies and puts the cans in his buggy and then gets pulled over for drunk driving. I mean, these are stories that happen in like large, you know, parties that are busted by the local sheriffs or something. These are true stories. In the same way that, you know, let's reflect back on our high school experiences. There was that segment of everybody's high school class of people that engaged in more rebellious behavior than maybe a lot of others. And percentage could vary depending on your school and your class, whatever. But by and large, Rumspringa just simply means a time that young people are able to socialize with one another without adult supervision. They also use this as a time to seek potential partners, make the decision about whether they're going to join the church formally, because this happens during Rumspringa before they get married. So it's, you know, it's a time of discernment, but it's not to be equated with automatically going out into, you know, the wild, wide world and sowing one's wild oats.
So what happens when a teenager decides that they don't want to join the church?
They move. They typically don't stay in the same community. In Wisconsin, we don't find too many, say, concentric circles of, say, Amish groups and then various flavors of more progressive Mennonites. That's different in places like northern Indiana, eastern Ohio, and southeastern Pennsylvania, which have had Amish presences going back, in some cases, over 200 years. And so you find, say, in a place like Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, that one can stay sort of in the same general proximity to where one grew up and then just simply join, say, a Mennonite church or another similar Anabaptist church there. In Wisconsin, people that make the decision not to join or in rarer cases join and then leave afterward, some may stay in the immediate area, but often others will, they will make the choice to relocate. They could move to a city. They could move to another state. They may decide to pursue other kinds of economic opportunities, family connections, that kind of thing.
Let's talk about the language. I know this is a big area for you that you studied. So what about the language, this Pennsylvania Dutch that they speak?
So Pennsylvania Dutch, despite its name, is related to German dialects. A lot of people think that the term Dutch in Pennsylvania Dutch is a mistranslation of the German word for German, which is Deutsch, Deutsch in Pennsylvania Dutch. And that's how you say in Pennsylvania Dutch, the name of the language is Deutsch or Deutsch. If you go back and you look in like, you know, the Oxford English Dictionary even, and but definitely in dictionaries of English from the 18th century, the word Dutch was basically the everyday word for German. Right. There was German was a later entry into the language. So it's just simply an archaic way of describing German or continental Germanic, European Germanic varieties. So Pennsylvania Dutch was a language that emerged in colonial Pennsylvania at the time that the Amish and Mennonites were migrating there. But they were just a teeny, teeny drop in the bucket as far as other German speaking immigrants from roughly 1710 to 1770. Most of these immigrants came from a region of Germany that's known in English as the Palatinate, the Pfalz in Germany, southwestern Germany. And they spoke a variety of dialects, and those dialects essentially with a generation or two coalesced together to, and then with an intermixture of English vocabulary because they were bilingual, they were using English. A new language developed already by the end of the 18th century that's known in English as Pennsylvania Dutch. And Pennsylvania Dutch into the 20th century was spoken mainly by non-Amish and Mennonite people. But those folks have by and large assimilated to speaking English only now. And it's really the Amish and traditional Mennonites who are the last speakers of Pennsylvania Dutch today. Okay. And the language is not mutually intelligible with standard German. So people know like standard German, school German, they may be able to pick out certain words, but it's the two languages really have diverged pretty strongly from one another.
We talked about Amish people who choose to leave, but very briefly, can outsiders choose to join the Amish? If I wanted to become Amish, could I do that?
Yes, it's rare. It was more common going back in history when the difference between being non-Amish and Amish was much less. You know, 150 years ago, everybody had horse and buggy transportation. Everybody was farming with horses. You know, everybody was dressing modestly. The way that an Amish person typically puts it today, it's like, well, you know, the reason that there aren't many people that join us is that it's a lot easier for us to go in your direction than it is for you to come into our direction. So to give things up. Of the roughly 350,000 Amish folks that are living in the United States and Canada today, Canada today, it's estimated that perhaps as many as, like, say, 200 were seekers who were born in non-Amish families who made the decision, typically as young people, to join the church. So it's pretty uncommon.
You're listening to Mark Loudon on Route 51 for a look at Amish communities in Wisconsin. When we return, we'll learn more about what draws the Amish to Wisconsin and why those communities are growing. Join us by calling 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Welcoming listeners from the West Side, I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward, welcoming listeners from the West Side. Our guest today is University of Wisconsin professor Mark Loudon as we continue our look into Amish culture and communities. We'd like to hear your questions too. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can join by phone at 800-780-9742. Mark, what are some of the biggest misconceptions about the Amish people?
Well, I think you've touched on a couple of them. First is that they don't want anything to do with the larger society, that they reject, you know, modern society and modern technology completely. As I said before, it's about kind of like selective interactions with society, including technology. Biggest misunderstanding is obviously having to do with Amish youth gone wild. Most of the stories about Amish people that make their way into the popular media are the sort of dog bites man kind of stories. So things that sort of out of the ordinary, and they kind of convey a somewhat distorted picture. But I think that, the Amish recognize that they're always going to be a minority in all the communities that they live in, and they realize that they're a little bit on display. And so they strive to be models, even though they're not actively engaged in mission work. They strive to be models to their neighbors in terms of, living their faith in everyday lives and being good citizens and neighbors.
Do they pay taxes?
Yes, they pay all taxes because they're part of the citizens of the United States and Canada. The only tax that they're exempt from is the Social Security withholding tax if they are self-employed. So if they're employed, say, like I mentioned before, many Amish in places like Indiana work in non-Amish enterprises like factories, then they have to have Social Security taken out of their paychecks. But they got an exception to the Social Security Act going back, I believe, in the 1950s because they, on principle, will not accept government assistance. So they don't accept handouts from the government. And therefore they say, we're never going to collect Social Security. So why should we, pay into the system? Mm-hmm. But again, that exemption is only for those who are self-employed. This kind of keeping government assistance at bay was expressed most recently during the pandemic when they, like all other taxpayers, received stimulus checks. And they said, what are we supposed to do with this now? Because we don't accept government assistance. And so government wasn't exactly sure. They didn't give like a return address for those checks. So it's so basically what people tried to do was mail them back. In some cases, they did send them back. Who knows what happened to the checks? Some, made donations to local charities and said, give it to the larger community, but we're not going to accept it for ourselves.
We have Mike on the line from Poinette. Mike, welcome to Route 51. You had a question. We were just talking about the taxes, but you were wondering about military service as well.
Yeah, I was just wondering if they believe in serving in the military or if they do any kind of military service. And I'll take the answer off the phone. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike.
Yep, thanks, Mike, for your question. This is an important one. So since the beginning, all Anabaptists have been non-resistant, which means not only pacifist, so like not serving in the military, but also not engaging in violence of any kind. So if somebody were to, punch you in the face, you could walk away, you could defend yourself or whatever, but you couldn't defend yourself by punching back, right? And so Amish and Mennonites members of the churches have never served in the military in a combat capacity. The last time that there was a draft during the Vietnam era, there were a number of Amish and Mennonite and Quaker and members of other groups who were called up who, declined to serve in a military capacity. And typically what they did was alternate service. So like working in, say, a hospital or a mental hospital and doing some sort of like, community service on the home front. And that was typically, these were terms of duty, like, you know, going on to a year and a half or 2 years. But it's been a problem, you know, in terms of outside perceptions, because there are some people that say, you know, it's like, you don't serve in the military and you're enjoying the benefits of you know, the protection that the U.S. military affords. And they say, well, we want to give back to American society in different ways, not in terms of fighting militarily. And that's a line that's very strongly drawn in the sand. They will not engage in violence of any kind.
And so it sounds like they're trying to find other ways to serve. What about voting?
There's no prohibition whatsoever on voting. Amish choose not to vote, especially in national elections. At various points, and most recently in 2016, because Amish live in swing states, especially the Republican Party was as keen to reach out to Amish voters, because Amish tend to live in red areas of America, so heavily Republican areas. If they were to be asked their sort of, you know, longstanding political sympathies, many would kind of describe themselves as sort of like armchair Republicans. In earlier times, before the 1960s, they would have described themselves as armchair Democrats. But they never have engaged in terms of like political activity or fielding candidates for office. And so they've tried to avoid voting in national elections. There was a perception, this is another talking about misconceptions. There was a misconception put out there that it was Amish voters in states like Ohio and Pennsylvania that pushed Donald Trump over the top in 2016. And there has been now analysis done of voting records and kind of doing some fine-grained analysis in key districts where their Amish are heavily represented. And it was found that for 2016, the Amish did not vote in greater numbers than they had in the past. And we're talking about like maybe 5% of, you know, eligible voters casting ballots. And so it made it, you know, just doing the math, it made actually no difference in swinging things towards the Republican Party in those states.
That's interesting. What about the photography thing? I've heard this a lot, that the Amish people are opposed to having photographs taken. Is that true?
Yes. That goes back to one of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not make a graven image. And so the idea, they consider in earlier times, human representations of any kind, so like portraits, and then later on when photography became available in the mid-19th century, that was an inappropriate violation of a commandment. It's also kind of goes in line with their desire not to be vain or placing too much value on their outward appearance. And they say, well, if you pose for photographs, that means that you're maybe kind of loving your appearance a little bit more than you should. And that could be sort of dancing a little bit close to a morally questionable line. So it's not like you're stealing their soul if, you know, a photograph is taken of them. And some families will maybe be a little bit more flexible in allowing photographs of children to be made, because they say children are not capable of vanity, right? Because they're not at the age of reason. But by and large, they would say that this is a violation of one of the Ten Commandments about graven images, and they'd see that as an inappropriate expression of vanity.
So one of the biggest changes in recent years that we've seen is the introduction of tourism in some Amish communities. And I know this is big in Pennsylvania, for example. You see endless advertisements for Amish communities and hordes of tourists that are flocking to these sites. Does that happen in Wisconsin? And how are they coping with that loss of privacy?
It's tricky. In Wisconsin, there's much less of an industry. It's mainly sort of business-based. And so it's not like, you know, bus tours and going to, you know, Amish farms or that kind of thing. It's much more small scale, but it's like, you know, take a tour to, you know, through, you know, a bus ride through Amish country, and then let's stop at a few Amish businesses, like a furniture shop or a bulk food store or that kind of thing. And that's considered less problematic because it's business, right? Sure. So it's like bringing customers to your store, and business owners wouldn't have a problem with that. And by and large, vast majority of Amish themed tourism in Wisconsin is extremely tasteful. So it's, you know, people understand you shouldn't be taking photographs, and these people are not in zoos or on display. A place like Pennsylvania, like Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, where the Amish themed tourist industry goes back basically 100 years. So like when automobiles became popular. And it gets a little bit tricky. And then you've got, you know, folks coming from all over the world, and like, you know, walking down people's lanes and like peering into their windows, or, you know, peering into schoolhouse windows and taking pictures of people as they're walking out to get their mail, maybe, you know, looking a little bit less fresh in the morning or something like that. So that feeling of kind of like being a little bit on display is uncomfortable, obviously, for anybody. I mean, this is not just an Amish thing. It's like, who wants to get their picture taken when they're out walking the dog in the morning?
Exactly. We have Claire on the line. Claire from Sauk County. Welcome to Route 51. What's your question?
Hi. Thank you, Cherie. How do the Amish afford to have so many children?
That's an interesting question, Mark.
Great, great question. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, if you were to look at an Amish tax return, you would see them as like, you know, a ton of deductions and very, very low income and assets, maybe not huge. And so they would, you know, by most standards be living at the poverty level or below the poverty level, and yet no one's starving, right? There's really no true poverty in the sense of like lack of things that they absolutely need. So like food and shelter and medical access to medical care. So how are they able to afford it? They're able to keep their overhead low. Their costs are very, very low. You know, you think about things like, you know, what we pay for cell phone charges, for internet, cable, gasoline to power our automobiles, the money to buy the automobiles, basically just their costs are quite low. And in terms of labor costs, they really don't have to hire too many people outside of their communities for, say, like sawmills and various other Amish enterprises, because they've got a lot of community members that can do this, including a lot of kids. I should say that, agriculture is not the main source of income for most Amish families today. That's an important thing to understand too.
That was my next question. What kinds of jobs do they have? How do they support themselves?
So basically the crisis that has affected small scale agriculture in America going back to really the 1960s and various peaks and valleys, and most recently with the dairy crisis in Wisconsin, that has affected Amish people as well. And so they've been very nimble, and they've always had sort of side businesses, but in recent years, those side businesses have become main businesses. So it's things like, and especially in Wisconsin, which was an important draw, things having to do with wood. So like furniture, cabinet making, home remodeling, you know, putting on roofs for non-Amish neighbors, you know, carpentry crews, dent and ding grocery stores, produce stands, all kinds of different sorts of cottage industries, we'd say.
You mentioned earlier about the growth of the Amish population. I know more Amish children are choosing to stay with their families, but they're limited in terms of potential partners. Why is this growth happening?
Well, they're not really limited in terms of potential partners because, you know, the percentage of males and females is the same. So, you know, there's really not a problem. There's not a skewed in terms of lots and lots of single females or single males. So it all kind of evens out. Basically, you know, the secret sauce is that they have very, very healthy lifestyles. Their life expectancy is high, very low infant mortality, low maternal mortality. And it's a very, very appealing choice to young people. They're off the scales in terms of their happiness quotients.
So if the entire population of the Amish people kind of hails from this group of a few hundred families, are there medical concerns when they have children, or, I mean, are there genetic issues that they worry about?
Yes and no. So basically, most societies around the world are closed societies, are marrying within their own. And so nature basically kind of selects for good genes. So they're immune from most genetic disorders because they're a closed society. But there are certain genetic disorders, as we see in any human population that's closed, per se, which is most around the world, that occur at a greater rate than in the general population. And that's a whole other area of medicine that we could talk about in another program.
Sure, sure. We have about 1 minute left, and I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about the talk that you're having at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point at Marshfield that's coming up. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, that's going to be a presentation on the Marshfield campus of UW-Stevens Point through their continuing education program, and specifically their LIFE program. That's going to be taking place at 10 a.m. So again, on December 9th, Thursday, December 9th at 10 a.m. on the Marshfield campus of UW-Stevens Point.
What's one thing that you wish people would understand about Amish people that they don't?
That they're human beings like the rest of us, and that they all, you know, want to live, you know, long, healthy, productive lives and be good citizens to their neighbors and to support each other as best they can.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a fascinating conversation. That is all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Glad to have listeners from the West Side today along for the ride. I'd like to thank our guest, University of Wisconsin professor Mark Loudon. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route51. Next week, we'll take a look at the Supper Club experience, so unique to Wisconsin, and in 2 weeks, a discussion on the housing shortages in our communities and what's being done to address that crucial issue. Until then, we're heading out of town.